options activity has altered the investment landscape. Get an edge on this massive flow of funds with Tier 1 Alpha's Market Situation Report, brought to you by HedgEye, a daily newsletter of the latest moves in the options market and a weekly webcast featuring myself, Mike Green of Simplify Asset Management, and Tier 1 Alpha's Craig Peterson and David Pegler. Go to HedgEye.com/research for more information.
Hi, I'm HedgEye's founder, Keith McCullough. If you like what you hear, you will love our investing research. We bring transparency, accountability, and actionable investing ideas to investors big and small. I'll put our investing process and team up against anyone in the world. Please visit HedgEye.com to subscribe and learn a better way to invest.
I'm Keith McCullough, and welcome to our Investing Summit. This is the sixth year that we've done this, so we appreciate your audience. There's a lot of replays that end up getting watched here. Obviously, we're going to go for 3 days in a row, three per day. So if I can hang in here with these heavy hitters, then I'll be just fine come day three. But I hope to learn a lot. The idea is, of course, not to have an interview. It's to have a real conversation back and forth with pros who we think are the best pros in the business and those that you should be paying attention to. There are a lot of things that you shouldn't be paying attention to. You got precious life and cycle time to take care of. So Lizanne knows a lot about that. She's raising a beautiful family. She's doing great. She's seemingly never gets any older. And you get to be the leadoff hitter for the third time in a row.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, unless you say no to me, we're going to ask you to do it again next time.
Sounds great. The only rub, I guess, is I don't get to watch others and then kind of riff off what other people have to say. I establish some sort of baseline, good or bad, but I love these conversations. So I'm very honored you ask me back each year, Keith. So thank you. And also, by the way, thank you for being one of our first guests on our new podcast that we just launched last fall. So got a lot of great comments about that episode. So thank you for letting me turn the tables on you a little bit.
Yeah, that was fun. And, you know, I'm sure you got plenty of feedback, positive and negative, as I tend to get. But you tend to get much more positive feedback, which is why.
Oh, I get plenty of negative.
I wanted to, but I did want to start with giving you a compliment on being. I think you were the first. I'm pretty sure you're the first, at least in my head, you're the first to call out just the reality of rolling recessions, right? Throughout an entire period of people debating, I don't think there was much of a debate from the 2021 cycle high, or that was the 21 global macro cycle high, never mind the U.S. economic cycle high, that the market collapsed and crashed throughout 2022. But there are a lot of things that happened throughout that, and I hate to put it inside of a calendar year, because that's not what cycles do.
Right.
Like we always say, it's cycle to date. It's not year to date. We get the people get paid year to date. But can you take a step back on that? Because rolling recessions for 2 years in certain things, by my definition, are really easy base effects. And actually, those recessions were currently long right now. But I wanted to remind people that a lot of these things happened all the way through last year.
Right. Yeah, so, and I will say that possibly as far back as we were using the term rolling recession to describe this unique cycle, I give credit to Ed Yardeni. That's been a thesis of his for some time, too. But it really, not that we're going to rehash the last 4 years, nobody wants to do it, but I think it is instructive to go back to the early part of the pandemic when things were basically still in lockdown, when the stimulus kicked in. As we all remember, that allowed for a very quick pickup in economic activity off the pandemic-related recession, but all of that stimulus and demand associated with it was funneled into the good side of the economy because we basically had no access to services. That also became the breeding ground of the inflation problem with which we're still dealing, very concentrated in those goods-oriented categories of inflation. But subsequent to that, we saw the rolling over. We had hard landings, rolling recessions in manufacturing and housing related. A lot of the consumer-oriented products that were big beneficiaries of the lockdown phase. We then had the rolling over. We went from hyperinflation to disinflation to deflation in some categories on the good side. But of course, we then rolled into the opening on the services side. So you had that offsetting strength. Services is a larger employer, helping in part to explain why the labor market has been resilient. The non-goods oriented categories on the inflation front tend to be stickier by nature, including the shelter components. So, and now we've started to see maybe a little bit of recovery on the manufacturing side. You know, the interesting kind of convergence now happening in the ISMs with manufacturing coming finally back above the 50 line for the first time since November of 2022, yet services weaker, at least relative to expectations. So I think that we might possibly continue to see this roll through. Now, last thing I'll say is there was enough weakness in the goods and manufacturing side of the economy to take GDP into negative territory for the whole first half of 2022. And of course, help bring on a bear market in 2022. And I'm not saying, you know, the NBER missed it in not declaring the first half of 2022 a recession. Two quarters in a row of negative GDP is not the definition of a recession. But the point is, the weakness was significant enough to bring GDP into negative territory and to help bring on a bear market. So it's not like we've just been whistling past this throughout this cycle. We've had implications. It's just we didn't get the official recession declaration by the NBER.
Yeah, and you know, the way to make money on this in the modern era, of course, is not to call a recession. It's to pick the sector styles, the factor exposures, as you well know, that work with the prevailing economic conditions. So let's just say last year, well, you're like, oh, see, nobody can call a recession anymore. And you're long China, I mean, or commodities, which is a pretty big asset class. You got killed because the global industrial, global manufacturing and global commodity recessions didn't end until the fourth quarter. So that, it's an empirical fact so far. Looking backwards, we can always re-enter a recession. But I wonder, like, how much because I want to definitely get into the inflation discussion next. But how much, how aware? Let's say how macro aware would the Federal Reserve be on the turning of the tides? Like, we've had a 27% inflation in the oil price in 3 months. The CRB broad index is up 15%. Bond yields have gone from 3.8 to 4.4 on the 10-year. I mean, there's nothing in those three things that an economist that is also a strategist like you, market practitioner, isn't getting signal all of a sudden that those recessions bottomed and demand is starting to reaccelerate.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. And every day when I hear another member of the Federal Open Mouth Committee, I think, please, somebody, don't use transitory to describe this bit of reflation that we've seen. Clearly, one word that has been used is, you know, it's seasonals. And that is something that, at least based on the most recent press conference, Powell, you know, is at least hoping that some of it is seasonal. I think we're tomorrow, I think, represents maybe the expiration date of the declaration of seasonals. And you're right. It's pretty much across the commodity complex. And, you know, the one piece of good news there is it may suggest we're seeing that the worst is behind us in terms of global activity. And then I've had retorts, well, don't worry about commodities. You know, the Fed only cares about core inflation and its core, you know, services, ex shelter and higher oil prices don't feed into that. But that's not really true. It does ultimately feed into it. All you have to do is, you know, do a double chart of you know, the some sort of commodity index and look at even core PCE. And with a little bit of a delay, you do tend to see an impact, not to mention the psychological impact. So, right. Certainly back in January, we were really vocal about saying the market had gotten way over its skis and expecting a March start and up to 7 cuts. That just made no sense at all. There was no data suggesting that that was appropriate for the Fed. Now the market is actually has an expectation of less than the 3 cuts that the dots plot. And I only mention the dots plot not because it's some roadmap for what the Fed is going to do. It's not, but that's the only kind of baseline we have. I think the Fed staying in pause mode for now actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, the bond market's telling them that. The currency market's telling them that.
Yep.
Of course, you in the equity market, you have the daily conniptions associated with 0 days to expiration options and all the flow dynamics there, that which aren't always fundamental. But just to put a slide on this, slide 55, which, again, I'm not convinced that the Fed can accurately nowcast or forecast anything, never mind something global. But this is called global PMI, which you're well aware of. Obviously, but look at that. I mean, that is a protracted recession, right? The cycle peaked on the left side, where the bars are black and they're at their highest point. Started to slow and then collapse and crash throughout 2022, but stayed pervasively negative. Yep. Now, two questions on this. One, I already asked part of it. One, do you think the Fed has that in whatever their calculus is for future inflation, that reversing? And two, why wouldn't they credit part of that, at least, on the commodity side of disinflation to, and CPI and PCE falling to begin with?
Well, in the answer to your first question, they should take that into consideration. You know, it is a bit, and I'm not a Fed basher. You know that. Yeah. I think the, you know, armchair quarterbacking of what the Fed is doing, should be doing, should have done. First of all, there's so many counterfactuals that I don't think that that's appropriate. That said, the reality is they're not providing calendar-based guidance, which, by the way, that's fine, although the market has now shifted to more calendar-based guidance. You know, will it be June? Will it be July? How many? But the data dependency, and with the sights so clearly on not just inflation, but specific metrics, which is inherently lagging in nature. So I'd like to see them talk a bit more.
Yeah.
Through sort of by their perspective, looking through the windshield, not the rearview mirror, at everything that's involved in generating inflation, not just things like average hourly earnings in a monthly jobs report.
Well, I mean, and I am a Fed basher, as you well know, but the I think they've earned it, and you're a much classier person than I'll ever be. So thank you for doing that. It's this hockey player thing I can't shake, right?
Yeah.
But if you actually hold their feet to the fire on this, they are seeking a target, right? Everything they say is in hope or in aspirance of getting to that target. It is never considering the forward outlook given the base effects on why inflation actually came down. I think that the answer to the second part of my question, if you go to slide 58, is actually that the Fed would have to acknowledge that we had rolling recessions, as Liz Ann Saunders called. I mean, this isn't the global cycle. This is the domestic cycle, which is impacted by the global cycle. Domestic industrial production was negative. Now it's coming off the cycle low.
Right.
So there's, and by the way, to your point, there's not one serious person on all of Wall Street that's on the buy side. I don't mean on the Fed mouth side. That's not P&L. There's not one person that would say that oil isn't in the top three leading indicators of future inflation. There's not one. I don't have one client who would say that. Now, there are some clients that I don't have that will never be clients because I say that. But just to the point on that, wouldn't they have to acknowledge, like in all their context and discourse, hey, look, we had rolling recessions.
Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at HedgeEye. Hope you're enjoying our podcast. Start generating alpha with our suite of Sector Pro investing research products. Dive deep into retail, industrials, technology, and everything in between with exclusive access to the sharpest analysts and actionable ideas on Wall Street. Go to HedgeEye.com/research to subscribe. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
I haven't heard them acknowledge that. You know,
right.
they've touched on, you know, pockets of weakness, but and they've talked about forces within the shelter components and within you know, broader housing components. But you're right, they have not brought that terminology into their discussion, and I think it's important. You're absolutely right, because I think the recessionistas, the ones that really had a much more negative, broad economic outcome, made the assumption, even if they weren't using sort of a rolling methodology, that services would eventually weaken, but you wouldn't get the offsetting pick back up on the manufacturing side with that sort of global reacceleration here. And so I think you're right. That's been missing in some of the chatter by the Fed, and I hope it comes back into the conversation, if not directly in a statement, hopefully in that some intelligent questions will be asked of Powell in the next press conference. Well, other thing, Keith, that I find really interesting in this whole parlor game of analyzing whether it's the warp function on Bloomberg or the CME FedWatch tool, this obsession over percent probabilities for the June meeting, for the July meeting, how many cuts. Until today, I have not seen any economist or Fed watcher come out with, here's what we think in terms of the start point, the number of cuts, on the basis of a projection of where inflation is going to be. It just seems like, well, I think it's June, I think it's July, I think it's going to be 2, I think it's going to be 4. And it wasn't until, I think, Krishna Guha at Evercore ISI today said, here are the scenarios. Here's the actual month-to-month change in core PCE and what the feeders of that would be. So there was actual backbone behind the assumption they're making in terms of the start point and the speed. Other than that, it's just people, throwing darts and at a month and then trying to figure out the number of cuts. So I think there needs to be more actual analysis of base effects, to your point, and how the math works in whether the Fed has any hope of seeing inflation get to their, somewhat arbitrary target of 2%.
I mean, the math is very easy on base effects. You're going to lose what was massive headwind, peak of the mother of all inflation. Guys, go to slide 26. Again, economy accelerate. Demand for things go up. Fed print money, inflation, deficit spending, as far as the eye can see, you got towards 9% at the peak. Right on the screws, Lizanne, that came within a quarter of the global economic cycle peak, the inflation peak. To disassociate that, and by the way, on the way down throughout the global industrial recession, to say that it didn't have impact is ridiculous. So I don't think we're going to actually ever have a full comprehensive conversation the way that you and I would have about this. But if we move to the forward outlook, I mean, what if I'm right? Nobody's been more right on inflation now casting than us. I've had other things wrong. Obviously, the calling for a broader recession would be one of them last year. But I get plenty of things wrong, and I got no problem accepting that. I mean, but look at the nowcast from Bloomberg. I mean, those are round numbers. Oh, we're going to go to 3, then we're going to go to 2.5, Lizanne. While the base effects ease north of 200 basis points and oil's up, oil could be up 30 to 40% by the time we lap those comps.
And I also think that we have definitively exited and not going back to the Great Moderation era that had so many secular forces sitting behind it, including globalization and China joining the WTA in 2001 and flooding the world with cheap and abundant access to labor and manufactured goods. Now we're geopolitical uncertainty is greater. You've got all the impacts of climate change. You've got 2 wars going on. I think this idea that with fits and starts, that inflation will get back down nice into that comfy 2% zone and just stay there. You got to add demographics into the mix. I just think even if we can continue to see some disinflation, I think the era we're in is one of more inflation volatility, more economic volatility, shorter cycles, but maybe more strength on the upside. In the Great Moderation era, we had longer cycles, fewer recessions, but you had weaker growth accelerations during the upside. For all the cheering about the recession, the expansion that ended with the pandemic in February of 2020, being the longest economic expansion in history, that's factually correct. But it was also the weakest by far in U.S. economic history. And so I think the environment we're in, and it's borne out by things like the inverse relationship between bond yields and stock prices for the most part. And it's not without opportunity in terms of investors and what to do in this environment. But I think it is different relative to the 20-25 years of the so-called Great Moderation.
Well, I mean, there's a long history to review there if we have time, and I'm going to come back to that. But just to give you the picture, I don't know if you've seen this from us or not, but on slide 107, guys, you can see, I mean, you shouldn't need 785 economists at the Fed. You probably don't even need seven. But this is just base effect math. Can you see this?
Yep.
Yeah.
I can't see all the words, but...
In the next 9 months, we're going to drop 230 basis points out of the base effect.
Yep.
Right? So why tell me how, you know how some of these linear econs think better than I do because they like you. But I'd love to hear the answer. How does the math work if the number one leading indicator, and if you don't want to use oil, then, and you don't want to use the commodities basket, and you don't want to use wage inflation, you don't want to use anything, that's different, okay? That's just political bias. But how does the math work when I drop, never mind 230 basis points out of the base effect, if I only dropped 150 basis points out of the base effect, with oil up 30% against that? How do you have a future inflation nowcast going down towards 2.5 and then 2, other than just needing it to go there?
That's the answer for most people. The combination of needing it to go there, not doing the math, and just taking the Fed at, you know, their word that we really like to start cutting this year. So
right.
That was my point about there's not a lot of math analysis that sits behind this parlor game of when they'll start. There's not the why.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what's interesting, though, and this is where, you know, you and I get paid and this is our livelihood. I mean, if you're not long of the assumption that inflation is higher for longer and actually going to reaccelerate because it already has, you're not getting paid right now. Inflation at every level is outperforming growth. Inflation in the last 3 months, right? When, again, you have to go back and that's why I want to establish that the global industrial manufacturing commodity cycle bottomed in the fourth quarter of last year. Because from that point, that's where you buy a cycle low in commodities, or buy a cycle low in energy stocks. The number one sector style in the U.S. stock market in the last 3 months is what, Lizanne?
Hi, Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at Hedgeye. Join our entire research analyst team live before the market opens for a deep dive investing analysis, our favorite stock ideas, and our risk manager-in-chief, Keith McCullough's macro overlay. Our team of 40-plus equity analysts discuss key market developments, trends, and our high-conviction long and short investing ideas. You will not get this granular level of insight anywhere else. A video replay, audio version, and analyst summary notes from the call are available shortly after each live show to ensure you don't miss anything. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe and tune in live to the call weekdays at 7:45 a.m. Eastern. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
Well, the last 3 months?
Yeah.
Is it still momentum?
It's, well, factor exposure, yes, that's one of them, but sector style.
Momentum has faded.
Yes, yeah, sector style.
Energy.
Right.
Yeah.
By a lot.
Energy, so, materials, industrials, financials. That's telling you something. And by the way, all you have to do is look at sector performance rankings. Look at, say, the past month, the past 3 months. But I don't think many investors have kind of caught up to that yet. You're only now starting to see some interest in the fund complex, be it the ETF side or the traditional mutual fund side. I still get asked all the time, when are the Magnificent Seven going to stop leading the market? And it's like, they have.
They already have.
So I think that there's a little bit of a sort of a delayed awareness, not even acknowledgement of the shift that has happened. And it's not just the shift toward more traditional cyclicals, but I also get asked all the time about, you know, how come the market has been so resilient? And I don't know if you've seen it. I put it on my Twitter feed every single day. It's just a simple performance table that looks at what the indexes have done this year. And in the case of this year, I'll use the NASDAQ as an example. Up, I don't know, 8% or so, not including the weakness today, no more than a 3% drawdown from a year-to-date high. But the average NASDAQ member has had a 28% drawdown from a year-to-date high. Mm-hmm. So there's a heck of a lot of churn and rotation going on under the surface. But if you only look at the index level, and you don't look on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis, there's still this assumption that the market's fine and it must be fine because we've got these, you know, mega cap, max seven kind of names in the driver's seat. And that's an important shift that, and to some degree, that happened to be calendar year based. But if you want to think in calendar year terms, first of all, if you want to think in calendar year terms, 2022 bear market year, those mega cap, the grade eight, as they were called at the time, dragged down performance. In 2023, they pulled up performance. And now it's not that they're dragging down performance. There's just a lot more going on under the surface that you have to pay attention to see what the real story is emanating from market leadership.
Yeah, I appreciate that you said that because, you know, especially given your, you know, your firm and your platform and the breadth of the audience you speak to, it's very frequent, let's just call this uniquely, in this uniquely American experience that is investing, that people will just say the market, right? I'll go to, you know, you and I both lived in Fairfield, you still have a house in Fairfield County, right?
No, just the apartment that we help our daughter rent in Stamford. And I miss my daughter in Connecticut, Keith. I miss seeing you in person at these things. I don't really miss living in Connecticut. It's 80 and sunny right now where I am. So, but wow, that's tangential.
That's just awesome.
I think you had a question.
But Connecticut's still Connecticut. I mean, you can go to any golf course in Fairfield County or in anywhere outside of New York City, and everyone will just ask you what the market's doing. Like, I mean, it's frustrating on a lot of levels, right? I mean, everybody loves AI and they love all technological innovation, but you know, God forbid we stop talking about the Dow and points. I mean, or talk about the market that way, where there's all this alpha. I mean, it's one thing if you're an orthopedic surgeon, you're a dentist or whatever. But if all you do is talk about the market as the S&P 500, I mean, you're not.
You don't, or if you only think of, when you think of AI, if you only think of NVIDIA, you know, there's an AI story behind copper,
yeah,
which is an input into power plants and data centers. And so I think you're right. I think there's this sort of monolithic lens that folks use when analyzing the market. And I totally agree with you. I think, and I get even one step down from the macro to, well, what do you think of small caps? Like as if it's this singular thing. You know, Russell 2000, I think, has, I don't know, 1800 and some odd stocks. It's not a singular thing. Half of them are not profitable. So I think, and with correlations, realized correlations down and dispersion widening out, I think arguably that's a decent backdrop, whether you call it for stock pickers, but certainly for the more fine-tooth comb analysts that don't think of things in just the market terms. I think that's a very good point.
Yeah, one really good way I find to connect with the people on this, because that's really a mission for you and I. It's not to cozy up to whoever at a golf course is some Wall Street person on that. That's ridiculous. If you just look in your account, you know, a typical target date fund, depending on your age, will have the Russell 2000. That's why a lot of people ask about it all the time. I mean, a typical target date, I mean, the Russell, first of all, is still down 15% from where it peaked in 2021. And if you're long that and your 40 is long TLTs or duration, you're getting smoked. Like, you're down double digit from where you peaked, you know, going all the way back to 2021. Just look in your account. Like, that's what people, that's the feedback that I get, the frustration that I get, is that you get these people just walking around talking about rainbows and puppy dogs all the time, whereas their account isn't that.
Right. Well, the same thing happens at the sector level. You know, you've got sector performance, which is easier to rank on a whatever time frame you want. But the, you know, sector ETFs have caps on individual stocks. And right now, there is, in terms of year-to-date performance, there's between a 400 and 500 basis point tracking error in the case of technology and communication services, where the ETFs tied to them are significantly underperforming because they have those weighting caps in terms of individual securities. So that's been another frustration. I think people don't even quite realize it. They're like, explain to me why, you know, my exposure to tech or comm services is less than what I see this sector has done over whatever period of time. And it's just an understanding of how these funds are structured and rebalanced and limitations.
I find great opportunity in that. I mean, I to me, it's a perverse thing to want and on the other side need the people to get better. But perversely, I want to play against that, right? You don't want people that you're playing against to be what we would call like quantamental, macro aware, factor aware, sector aware, because they would catch up with you. So it is shocking to me, if you can't tell, that I still, after all these years, you know, we've still just kept that alpha at Citadel or Millennium or Balyasny or anybody who actually knows what they're doing when it comes to what we're talking about here. But I do think that, you know, going forward, it's a huge opportunity. I mean, every night, my rooster, one of my analysts, goes through over 2,700 ETFs in terms of signal strength, how they fit in an inflation environment. That's what we're clearly trying to get longer of, is inflation, while the government says there is none. But that's it. The wealth of opportunity there in terms of what's not true to your point. Oh, that I'm long technology, but really it's like, you know, XLK, which has three stocks or 50% of your exposure. And Apple's part of the terrible too with Tesla. Its performance sucks. So, you know, versus take something else that we find and it's appropriately got an equal weight potentially, if that's what we're looking for. I just think that the work can be done now and it can be done a lot faster and you can implement it much cheaper, right? Like, because you don't have to pay the fees that for half our career you and I would have to pay if we wanted to execute on something.
Right. But I think, you know, oftentimes the individual investor, especially newer entrants into this world of investing, they think of it's almost like, you know, soundbite investing as opposed to deep dive investing. And that and it's one of the reasons why I love these conversations, because I do a lot of financial TV and they're short segments and they want the sound bites, and it does get distilled and even more so in the social media world. And I think a lot of newer entrants into this world of investing don't understand the necessity of a lot of deep dive analysis and work.
And I think they can be taught. I mean, admittedly, I've struggled as a coach. I can play a lot better than I can coach, I think I've realized, but I'm working on it. You know, I'm trying to get people to understand some of these basic, you know, building blocks so that they can start to build what we call like a full investing cycle process. But it's not hard to go to somebody younger that might be a big I hate this word, like aficionado or, you know, of crypto. I mean, that means that you're just always going to be long, I guess. But, you know, crypto, IBIT, which is now a very liquid ETF, is up, you know, Bitcoin's up 62% this year. I mean, oil's up 22% this year. You know, these are massive moves in big things that people know, right?
Look at gold.
Yeah, gold's up 13%. Silver just went up 10% last week. You know, so they're... Again, that's the opportunity. And I think it's very hard for somebody, if they're all still wedded to what happened in 2023 year to date, but they don't want to talk about what happened in 2022 year to date when they got body bagged. They're going to sit there and they're going to review this year, and it might be too late before they actually get long inflation. Because even if you're long duration, you're mispositioned for inflation, right? TLT being the very obvious and widely held example. I mean, the thing is straight down as inflation's gone straight up. And, you know, not one person at the press conference of the Federal Reserve might put up their hand and say something like that.
Yeah, and I think you're right. When you look at the sector flows, like I said, it's really only in the past week or so that you're starting to see more interest in funds that are tied to the energy sector. Yeah. The flows are still very heavily biased toward technology, and you're right. It's very rear view mirror investing and classic performance chasing.
Now on the longer term question, I have one picture here that I dog-eared while you were speaking. If you go to slide 103, because all this still happened, right? We still have triple digit debt to GDP. We're still clocking at 1.7, 1.8 on the deficit, and we're going to go to 2.5. You know, if you take a long-term view and you think of, you know, the phase one sobriety, phase two ZERP party, MMT for all, and what's going to happen in the post, How much have you thought about this? Like how long-term and structural deficit spending is for inflation and higher for longer inflation? Just to use one very basic example.
Well, so I guess the only rub to that thesis is that what's happened in the past anyway is when you have an ever rising high burden of debt, it all else equal tends to put downward pressure on economic growth measured in metrics like GDP and productivity and job growth, which eventually can also keep a lid on inflation. But so much of the analysis that we do on deficit spending or going from deficit to surplus mode, like in the 1990s, was in this great moderation era where we didn't really have much of an inflation problem to deal with domestically or globally. And, you know, I don't know that it's ever appropriate to fully throw out the window a playbook, but I think you're right. When I think about the impact of that on inflation, it's hard to think of it as benign as what we witnessed during the Great Moderation era. You know, the one problem with this really sort of ugly forward-looking set of charts on the deficit of the overall federal debt, or God forbid you add state and local debt and all household sector debt, financial sector debt, not financial sector debt, and all the future debt associated with our unfunded entitlements. And then you get to something like 1,000% of GDP. Here's the rub, Keith. You and I can talk about this. You and I can talk about why it matters. But for now, anyway, other than the investor class, it doesn't appear that constituents care that much about it. When they see numbers in the trillions, it's hard for them to quantify what that means for themselves. And with constituents not focusing on it, you therefore don't have adults in the room in Washington wanting to address this openly and honestly. So it sort of is what it is. Ideally, we get to a point where debt growth is lower than economic growth, because then you start to chip away at the problem. But we're not there yet, obviously.
I mean, finally, we have some, and it's a little disappointing, but it's still okay. Finally, like I guess many would call Jamie Dimon an adult in the room. I mean, in his letter, he called out what he could have called out for the last year and a half or two or five. I mean, which is nice. Stan Druckenmiller has been talking about this forever. Of course, he's got a political angle to it as well. But I mean, it's fiscal conservatism.
Neither side is practicing it, though. Let's be honest.
No, it's not. That's not the part. I mean, Trump's not going to get fiscally tight. Are you kidding me? I mean, he might have a debt jubilee on his own debt and get it, you know, get it. What are they doing? Student loan, forgive it all type thing. I mean, but like, go to the next slide, guys. Slide 104. I mean, it's one thing to have a year where you have emergency spending. It's another thing entirely if you go to the right side there where you have the new abnormal where you get that deficit spending every single year for 30 years from now until 2054. I mean, that is outright frightening.
There's nobody running on stopping that. It could be, you know, it takes a crisis to arrest it, which politicians are very good at kicking the can down the road until it crisis comes, and then they're forced to reckon with whatever it is that they need to reckon with. Often the case, debt. In this case, it's not debt within the global financial system like in 2008, but of their own doing.
Yeah, it becomes quite an onerous line item, interest expense, if you hold these levels of interest rates or, you know, see them go higher.
I think it's already leapfrogged defense spending.
Yeah. I mean, it's again, it's my partner Neil Howe would call this the fourth turning, where again, it's an entire generation that becomes complicit, not a party. Both parties are complicit in the same thing. I didn't want to get into a political debate. I just wanted to get into those numbers because people just don't take the time. Or to your point, once you get to trillions, they're just numb to the numbers. But I hear it a lot. I mean, you talk about the conversation at the golf course.
I hear it a lot. That's why I said the investor class cares deeply about this. Kate, I cannot remember the last time I did a client event, virtual, in-person, high net worth individuals, advisors on our platform. So different ilks in terms of the audience. I can't remember the last time the first question wasn't about this topic.
Really?
So the investor class cares deeply, but I think the average constituent and their representatives don't care.
It's man, what an amazing thing. I mean, Peter Turchin calls this the state, the elites, and then the rest of us. I'm fortunately part of the rest of us. I do like being part of that crew because we're talking about numbers that are on the page. Mm-hmm. They're not going to go away from my kids, right?
Right.
I'm not going to give away how old your youngest daughter is because people.
I have 27 boy and 24 girl. I have the big 6-0 coming up in a few months. I don't shy away from either saying my age or letting people infer it based on the age of my kids. It is what it is.
I still don't think I think people just saw their first point of fake news on the hedge.
Oh, no. I'm a 1964 baby.
No, that's and congrats. That's awesome.
Oh, but, yeah. I'm a baby boomer.
think of their kids. I have an 8-year-old still. I think I'm going to be 90 when she gets married. But I mean, it's like this is not acceptable to a lot of people. Right.
That's right.
And now the solution to this is going to be to teach our kids to forgive their student loans that they said that they were going to pay back. In fact, some of those will create a rule where the ones who really didn't even try to pay it back, those are the ones who get forgiven first. I mean, the things that
speaking
are going
of, on. Speaking of teaching, by the way, let me get on a soapbox here proverbially. How is it that we don't teach financial literacy, at least at the high school level, if not even sooner? This so drives me crazy. I don't understand it. I made myself such a pest with the principal of Darien High School, where my kids went, about why don't you have a course in financial literacy? And she would often come back and say, well, we've got a stock picking club. I said, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about picking stocks. I'm talking about basic financial literacy. What is the deficit? What does debt mean? Your own personal finances, your first paycheck. What's all the stuff that gets taken out of it? What's the benefit of compound interest? How do you balance a checkbook? What's a 401k? What's an IRA? It's incredible. I watched my daughter probably when she was early in high school or in middle school spend, I don't know, a couple of hours drawing a map of ancient Mesopotamia. And I thought, yeah, okay, history and geography, but she didn't at that time know anything about. I remember when she got her first paycheck as a working person. She came to me and said, what's all this stuff?
It's amazing, actually, at this age, and I'm 49 years old. I'm going to be 50 this year. So that's why I have an 8-year-old.
I got a decade on you. Yeah.
But at this, I just finished reading The Silk Roads. And I don't know if you've ever read that, but instead of looking at it like a uniquely American or Canadian experience with history, you're looking at hundreds of years of history instead of 2,000, 3,000 years. You wouldn't know where to put Mesopotamia in the context of what's going on in the Middle East today. Right. You wouldn't know that the British established this and that the Americans perpetuated that. You wouldn't know how angry these people are and how, you wouldn't know that. But I wouldn't be able to take something from that, which is written in 2015, by the way, and say what I just said, unless I had what you said, which is the foundation of financial literacy, economic literacy. Because you can't put you're reading a narrative, but you can't put it in context. Right. And I think that that's the most important thing that you're saying, which is super important to establish the foundations early so that you don't turn into, what is the alternative? I'm sure you've heard it from your kids, or they're right around the age where I hear it a lot. Oh, only invest what you could lose. YOLO. It's like, really? I mean, who the hell taught you that?
That's social media.
Yeah. They think it's like a video game. So, the debt's not a video game. By the way, show that slide 95. This would be the first slide of the class by Liz Ann Saunders at Darien High School. Just a casual addition of $1.4 trillion in 6 months here, guys. it's crazy. I mean, it's crazy. So we'll see, we'll see where that goes. I guess my last question on that, Powell's gotten away with a lot of things at these press conferences. And again, I'm not bashing, I'm just stating facts. I mean, instead of, actually, I'll read what he said because you sent it to me as a reminder, on inflation. He said, the overall story, which is that inflation's moving down gradually on a sometimes bumpy road towards 2%. Well, that's what you want to have happen, but that's not what's been happening for the last 3 months. Okay. Right. And there's nothing, like a third of GDP last year, people wonder why consumption remained resilient or the jobs market remained strong until they revised the numbers down. A third of the job ads were government spending, financed by the deficit, and almost the 20-25% of GDP growth was government spending. So on the one hand, we don't even talk about that. On the other hand, we're still going to have to live with that. So I wonder, like, what you've thought about, like, we call it the big G, you know, government's deficit spending, et cetera. I mean, I don't know how you could say that there's no impact on wage inflation when all those jobs were printed by the government.
Yeah, so I think that's been a big force behind the health of the economy and consumption. But I also think, and I got a question this morning on Bloomberg TV about the health of the consumer and just how resilient the consumer has been in the face of the traditional metrics around, you know, the traditional savings rate and what impact that has had or will have on the stock market. And I sort of flipped it. I said, I think it's more vice versa. I think the obviously deficit spending has been to the benefit of things like jobs, but also we've had what, $13 trillion of net worth added since the bottom, their near-term bottom in the equity market back at the end of October of last year. And that's in the context of $19 trillion of consumer spending. So that has also been an incredibly powerful force, but arguably maybe a bit tenuous. I think the consumption side of the economy, leaving aside government spending, I think rests on the combination of the labor market, which is as a tie-in to the government side of things, but also the net worth gains, courtesy of mostly the stock market until recently, to some degree in the bond market too.
Yeah, it's those questions, God bless you for answering them, because it's such a generalization, really, like from a, oh, the consumer's resilient. I mean, we have an explicitly K-shaped recovery where 50, let's just use round numbers, 50% of Americans have no money left and are struggling mightily to make ends meet. And we have us, Fairfield County, just, you know, great. As long as you're long inflation and inflation of your asset prices, you're doing great. I mean, there's no doubt about it. So
yeah, and that's why, that's another reason why I say, when we talked about it earlier, the monolithic lens that you shouldn't look through as it relates to things like, you know, small caps. Same thing with analyzing the consumer. I think during the stimulus burst phase, yes, you could monolithically look at consumption patterns, but now you've really got to take it by, you know, at least quartiles, if not deciles, and analyze debt levels and delinquencies and default rates. You've got to have a fine-tooth comb these days in any kind of analysis, be it of the economic data, the inflation data, consumption, stock market behavior, et cetera.
Well, since most people didn't get that education at Darien High School that you were recommending, and last I checked, they don't have that at Staples High School in Westport either. And I think really the only fighting chance that the people that are watching this and or their kids, more importantly, have is to take some time. You know, every day you can be indoctrinated to the flow of the cycle through Liz Ann. She tweets, you know, awesome flow without the attitude that I have, by the way. It's great. and you can start to get people to embrace things like the cycle, economic gravity, deficits and debt. I just think, you know, you and I were no spring chickens anymore, but we have a lot of work to do. I mean, there's a lot of education to be had. And, you know, for better or worse, not a lot of people are willing to provide that. But
and a lot of the education is not just what matters, but what doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of what we probably think doesn't matter all that much are some of the same things that investors think matter a heck of a lot.
Awesome. Well said. That's why you're our leadoff hitter. We're out of time.
Thank you for
joining me as always. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
She's Liz Ann Saunders. I mean, how good is she? Awesome. Like, in principle, she's awesome too, right? Think about Wall Street. Not everybody's here to educate you. A lot of people are in the business of selling you what? their stock. We'll be back.
Thanks for listening to the Hedgeye Investing Summit, featuring conversations with some of the sharpest minds in investing. To get access to the other 8 Hedgeye Investing Summit conversations and for more great investing content, go to Hedgeye.com.
Don't forget to check out Hedgeye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @Hedgeye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by Hedgeye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the contents. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the terms of service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.